Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. This is Eric Loomis, and as some of you know, I am a scholar of the timber industry and the ways in which the vagaries of global capitalism have transformed this industry in the Pacific Northwest over the years. And I'm very happy today to talk to another scholar of the timber industry. We are here today with Michael Hilliard, who is a professor of economics at the University of Southern Maine. And we're going to talk about his brand new book, Shredding Paper, The Rise and Fall of Maine's Mighty Paper Industry, published last year, 2020, by Cornell University Press. Michael, thank you for joining us.
It's my pleasure to be here, Eric.
Would you start by describing your book and what brought you to write about the Maine paper industry?
Sure. My book tells a big story about the long arc of the Maine paper industry from the mid-late 19th century up until about the year 2000. I would say my two lenses are the history of U.S. political economy. So I'm very much into telling a story of how the paper industry was part of the mass production revolution, what some historians call the second industrial revolution in the United States about 130 years ago. And then how the political economy changed in the late 20th century, and we'll talk a little bit more about that, but sort of like, you know, what factors led the industry to become sort of like older in the tooth and then undergo a really kind of brutal decline and trying to unpack the forces that caused that. At the same time, my book is very much a labor history. I did over 150 oral history interviews. It's about bringing together the sort of bottom-up and top-down perspectives. My book tells the story of a very kind of unique and fascinating labor process in the paper industry, which had all kinds of implications for workplace culture. And then as the industry started to undergo stresses and the political economy changed after 1960, there was a lot of, you know, what you might just sort of simply call class struggle or class conflict between labor and capital, a lot of dramatic strikes, underlying social movements, influencing those. So those are the stories that I try and tell in my book.
So our listeners might be like, the paper industry. I don't know anything about the paper industry. This seems really obscure or whatever. But what you're really doing is providing us a case study of the rise and fall of American capitalism or American manufacturing and the American labor movement. As a kind of way to expand on your intro, how is this story one that tells us a bigger story about the rise and fall of American labor and American manufacturing, which obviously paper is a huge political issue in Maine, but each part of America has this issue in its own different way.
Absolutely. Well, so I guess a place to start would just to say that, you know, as somebody trained in political economy, there's a great expression from an economist named Joseph Schumpeter from about 70 years ago called creative destruction. And it's about how capitalism is, which he basically got all of his ideas from Marx, if you dig into a little bit. In both those, theorists of capitalism pointed to the fact that capitalism is very dynamic and innovative. And so industries burst onto the scene and grow to fruition and with it create whole, ways of life, sectors of the economy. But then at some point, those industries will, there's an industrial cycle in which forces will come along and lead to stagnation and decline. So, that's something that's true of all the major manufacturing industries, and even in this era, retail industries as well. So, the origin story of the Maine paper industry is fascinating. And my tagline at the beginning of the book is that Maine was the Detroit of paper, just no one knows that. So if you're going to tell a Detroit-like story that most people would be familiar with, because Detroit is famous, as is the U.S. auto industry, there's just as juicy and interesting a story there with paper. The the industry came to Maine because we had made paper for a millennium out of cloth rags, linen, and then later cotton as a basic fiber. And with the Industrial Revolution, the massive growth of population in the United States, all that kind of stuff, literacy, there was no way that there's going to be enough rags to make enough paper for the growing audiences and markets for paper. So in the mid to late 19th century, there was a lot of work done by inventors and chemists and so forth to figure out how to make paper from trees. And then it turned out that Maine had the unique geography that made it the place to be, because we had seven river systems with lots of waterfalls, so you could build hydroelectric dams, big thing around 1890 when industry started. But mainly the trees and the rivers as a way of bringing the trees to the mills, and you know, water is also used heavily in production. So basically, big investors from New York came in the 1890s and the decades after there, and built these massive mills in the wilderness of Maine. And it created a way of life, and the way of life was very much centered around the kind of craft requirements of making paper. So one of the things I explain in the book is just how, unlike an assembly line where you can really standardize production, every run of paper was sort of like a touchy souffle. In some of the research I did, workers and engineers would describe that it, you know, it would take 287 different tweaks and adjustments to make a good run of paper. And so what it meant is that there was a generous paternalism in the industry from the start, because you needed a real collaborative spirit between the workers and the owners. And later on in the century, what happened is that, you know, other regions and new ways of making paper brought Maine into competition, particularly with the South. But then the biggest thing that I tell, and I can just sort of sketch it now and we could dig into more of it, is that, you know, since 1960 in the United States, there's been an evolution in the way corporations are run and governed. And so the 60s saw merger movements, which meant much bigger agglomerations of capital, which had implications for how local businesses were managed. So you had Maine paper mills that had been inherently local in character, that had, you know, the sons and grandsons of the founders still leading the mills for many generations. You had all of that. And that gets disrupted in the 60s when there's this national merger movement, and Maine paper mills get absorbed by companies like Scott and Georgia Pacific. And then the big story is what happens after 1980. And so I tell a story in the book that says that, you know, when people in 2021 in the United States concerned about the fate of rural or small town blue collar industry and working in the United States, when people wonder about why that has been under such pressure and decline for decades, people generally think of like globalization, maybe after that automation. So it's either China or it's robots. But the other factor, which is sort of least understood, is that there was a change in both the philosophy and the structure of how corporations were owned and managed. So everybody's sort of generally familiar with the fact that sort of short-term profit maximization in response to Wall Street pressures came on in the 70s and 80s. But few people realize just how definitive it was in the changing the way in which business were run. And basically what I learned in my research over about 15 years is I had, you know, managers, mill managers, you know, production managers, and workers of all levels describing in myriad ways how this new financialized way of running corporations basically disrupted, starved, and in many ways destroyed this kind of industrial heritage. And did so gratuitously. And so, you know, the best way to kind of summarize it is that the U.S. paper industry came under strong pressure from global competition in a new way only after China entered the WTO, World Trade Organization, in 2001. And most of the decline of the industry that I describe in my book took place in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And it was really that what some economists would call either shareholder primacy or financialization, but sort of the Wall Street takeover of American industry.
I guess what we can do, and there's so much we can build on there, but why don't we sort of march through this, right? Because there is, you know, this history of capitalism in the region that is I don't know if unique's the right word, but it's a little different than, you know, than say at GM or at, you know, U.S. Steel, perhaps. And then you do have the rise, though, of and we haven't gotten to this yet, of some pretty significant strikes and some really, you know, some pretty intense worker militancy. And so, you know, you focus a lot on the Warren Company, and I'm wondering if you can you know, use this company as a way to explain more about what the development of paper capitalism looked like in Maine.
Oh, great. Yeah, I mean, so I mentioned in the book that there was like, you know, 14 major mills, and then some, you know, especially go back far enough, a lot of smaller mills in the state. You know, it would be such a massive research undertaking to do a case study of all of them. So I'm super familiar with the histories of some of the big companies like Oxford Paper Company and Great Northern Paper, Fraser in particular. But the S.D. Warren Company is 4 miles from my house. And so I was able to do much more extensive research and interviews early on. So this story of the S.D. Warren Company is that it was actually the first big paper company in Maine. It was briefly the largest paper mill in the world in the 1880s. And so it specialized in high quality publication papers, so corporate annual reports and glossy magazines and things like that. It was a very innovative corporation. A lot of these companies, all these companies really became experts in their own technology. So they there's a lot of chemistry involved in paper making. And so they were hiring chemists from MIT as early as the 1890s, and that happened at S.D. Warren. And by the 1920s, most of the major mills in the state had research and development labs, like formal research and development labs, sometimes in the middle of nowhere with some top scientists from the Northeastern universities. So there were always proliferating new forms of new commodities and new processes. They're inventing new products and getting the most out of their paper machines. And one of the things I explain in the book is just how versatile this large continuous process paper machine called the Fredrinier is. You can make just about anything on it that looks like paper. So there was really great prosperity. The company grew to about 3,000 employees in the 1960s. And because of the really specific founders culture that went back to Samuel Dennis Warren, a Protestant noblesse oblige Puritan from the mid-19th century who founded the company. And there was always this ethos that, you know, the company's going to take care of you from cradle to grave. So it avoided the unionization that happened in most of the industry in the 30s and 40s in Maine. But even those other mills that unionized, in many cases, you know, if you know your labor history, there was the AFL-CIO and the CIO. The CIO was new in the 1930s and 40s and was quite radical. And so, like a lot of American employers, the Maine paper mills invited the AFL unions, which are easy to deal with, into their mills ahead of being organized by the CIO. But overall, there was very little, there was a period of about 50 years of labor peace in Maine, even after unionization, because of the paternalism, the generosity, the sort of strong mutual understandings between owners, managers, and workers. That all changes in the 1960s. Just about every major mill in Maine had a significant strike between 1964 and 1980. In the case of S.D. Warren, the proximate thing was that it finally unionized after, you know, there was many organizing attempts in the 30s, 40s, and 50s that all failed at S.D. Warren because the workers felt, you know, a sense of loyalty to the employers. But that changed. You know, one of the things that happens after World War II is that a lot of the country becomes unionized. And people with union culture and politics move around. And so, you know, one of the future leaders of the first S.D. Warren major union, Marv Ewing, was literally trained as a union leader in his 20s down in New Jersey and then married a woman from the town where the S.D. Warren mill was. So you have this infusion of new union culture, the beginning of sort of countercultural politics in the 60s, which had a blue-collar component. Amongst young people. And the company had sort of lost its touch with managing its paternalistic bargain. There was a lot of sort of favoritism and sexual harassment, things like that, that went on the shop floor. So it became vulnerable to unionizing, and it did in 1967. Had a big strike in 1976. and a threatened strike in 1970. They took a strike vote with like 95% for the biggest union. And so what happened is that the union locals that emerged there at SD Warren became actually quite militant, kind of a flip from the paternalism that existed before. And so the nature of the strikes in the mid-60s and through the late 70s had a couple different characteristics. One was that workers were feeling their oats, the economy was strong, and they were looking for better wages and benefits and better, contracts. And so it was a period of success in bargaining for that. But at the same time, as new larger companies came in to own these mills, there was efforts by these companies to try and speed up the workplace and things like that, that also spawned strikes. So there were strikes that were provoked by both the workers' own initiative to try and make things better for them and their resistance to the beginning of top-down pressures that they'd never seen before. So that takes you up to 1980. And then the 1980s and the first half of the 1990s is a period unto itself. So that's when financialization hits the state. You have companies like International Paper and Boise Cascade that came to own one of the historic mills, a company that had been called Oxford for most of its history. And they came in with the brutal people may know the story of the Hormel local P9 meatpacking strike in 1986. So what you had is that you had new CEOs who were who the folks on Wall Street, the institutional investors, had their ear, and they were saying, look, paper is a lumbering giant. It's a huge industry. It's profitable, but its profit rates are low. And that's because you pay your workers too much and the unions kind of hold up the work process too much. So when you put that all together, the union contracts and the workers themselves kind of had a bullseye on them. So there was a low road approach, which was literally to provoke strikes, having recruited strike breakers to become permanent replacements of these employees. And that happens in Rumford and Jay in between 86 and 88. At the same time, other CEOs trying to resist Wall Street said, let's try and do a high road approach. And let's see if we can cooperatively get the workers to go along with reorganizing work, changing work rules in ways that increase productivity and quality. And this proved to be controversial for a couple of reasons. One of which is that it just flew into the face of this specific union culture that existed within the paper industry with very specific kind of division of labor, lines of progression, things like that. There were codified union contracts. And of the many union leaders that I interviewed over the years, defense of the contract was the core of their identity. So these high road initiatives were an attack on the contracts, or was perceived as such. But the other thing that happened that was fascinating, this is a geography story, is that if you pour low road and high road strategic initiatives into labor relations in a confined geographic space where the workers in the mills like Scott and SD Warren that were being where their employers were sort of inviting them to do this high road cooperative thing, but would ask for some concessions in the process. These were workers that were going up on the weekend and going to rallies in Jay, where workers are being fired and replaced by a rapacious corporation. And some of the tactics of the low road companies like IP and Boise Rumford were being deployed in the high road experiments in places like SD Warren, which at that point become part of Scott. And so the level of distrust and understandable distrust was really, really quite advanced. And so it turned out that workers at SD Warren in the end, sort of joined the rest of the paper workers in the state saying all of these initiatives, whether high road or low road, are basically a class war on paper workers. In interesting ways, local radical union leaders in the paper industry and a very pivotal speech that Jesse Jackson came and made at Jay Maine in 1987, where he really framed the language of a class war of corporations on workers. Because, again, that was going on across the country and this was happening in other industries. And the paper workers of Maine largely bought it. So there was this kind of radical anti-corporate political conscience that sort of spread throughout the industry. And in the end, one of the things I tell about S.D. Warren, what happens is that, so, you know, 6 years of this attempt to reorganize work, to cooperate and collaborate and do things to sort of raise quality and productivity, which had worked well at one particular Scott Mill in Maine because of different circumstances there. But at S.D. Warren, the union kind of played along after a while. And they actually, in fact, voted finally in 1994 to accept a major set of changes. And literally like the next month, the investors on Wall Street who held the stock of Scott Paper said we'd had enough of the CEO kind of playing around in the sandbox with these initiatives. You know, profits are still too low 5 or 6 years later. So we're shutting the whole thing down. They brought in a guy named Chainsaw Al Dunlap to rip up the company. So Dunlap shut down all the labor management cooperation initiatives. Initiated a series of layoffs that eventually led to about a third of Scott's 25,000 workers losing their jobs within about 15 months. One of the union leaders said all the layoffs were like cutting the dog's tail off one inch at a time. And in the end, when you get to the end of that period, Scott gets broken up and sold to two different companies, and stockholders walk away with $6 billion in windfall profits. And Chainsaw Al himself, for doing this, got paid $120 million for 15 months work destroying a company. And I document in my book how some mills that had really been revived by these new initiatives and were highly profitable, you know, had met these higher profit targets that Wall Street wanted. But as a result of the fallout of all these machinations, they kind of got ripped up and closed down. And so some very strong mills that should have been around for at least another 10 or 15 years were kind of put out of business by all these maneuvers.
When you talk about the ways in which you have the kind of rise of a class consciousness among these workers and a radicalization, and you point out as well that this financialization of the economy is happening across the nation, you know, is there a sense that these workers see themselves as part of a larger struggle outside of the paper industry, or do they see themselves as kind of isolated within an industry under attack in this particular place, and they don't necessarily have a lot of connections to steel workers or even timber workers in the Northwest, as an example of my own personal interest?
Well, you know, what I would say is that there was a kind of radical moment. I kind of argue that there was a movement culture of anti-corporate, you know, class consciousness in the late 1980s and early 1990s. So you know the story of the Jay strike, as do I. And what the organizers at Jay did following the civil rights movement model from the early 1960s, you know, of SNCC and SCLC, is they held weekly rallies with singing and labor leaders from not just all over the United States, but all over the world. And of course, you know, Jackson came when he was in the middle of running for president for the second time. But he was very much about showing up on picket lines then, the way Bernie Sanders does now. And so, no, I think they really did see themselves as connected to a kind of national and global struggle. And, you know, part of what they did is they did a corporate campaign. So the idea was to pressure the people who are on the board of directors of International Paper. So they started going to Boston and, you know, picketing banks and things like that. So they started to see the connections across industry. So I really do think that the kind of, you know, nub of how that struggle unfolded really brought people together to see themselves as part of a larger struggle. And then in the case of S.D. Warren, you know, and again, had been absorbed by Scott, but they still thought of themselves as S.D. Warren. You know, when they were trying to figure out how to deal with these high road initiatives, they brought in people, Jane Slaughter from Labor Notes, who's one of the leading labor radicals. And she and Mike Parker had written books and articles and did trainings about how to resist these high road initiatives as ways of perceiving them as a wolf in sheep's clothing. So you take that all that together and, you know, you think about how political cultures get built amongst people who are going through something really dramatic. And it has to do with all of those interactions in rooms or, you know, either in rallies, if it's in a a high school gym with 2,000 people or training meetings with 20 or 30 people. But when I interviewed some of the union leaders or former union leaders at S.D. Warren about 10 years later, they were walking right out of a radical political economy class at UMass. I mean, they had the whole thing on the way Japanese and German capitalism was different than it was here. And, you know, they were well trained. They had learned quite a bit. And, you know, for social and labor historians, you know, movement cultures get built, you know, in myriad ways that have to do with interactions. And part of it is having that kind of, the presence of people who come from whoever. I mean, 100 years ago, it would have been the itinerant IWW Wobbly, you know, organizer who comes to town and teaches people how to think about their circumstances. We had a lot of that in Maine in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
You know, one of the stories that we often tell as labor historians about that period is a kind of disconnect between the rank and file and big international union leadership, right? You brought up the Hormel P9 strike in Minnesota in the 80s, in which, you know, which is, of course, one of these iconic strikes. And if you listeners have not seen Bar Koppel's American Dream, it's a depressing but pretty realistic vision of unionism at that time. That these workers are almost fighting as much against UFCW international leadership as they are against Hormel. Is there a similar kind of interaction here? Or maybe another way of asking this is, when you have this kind of radical political economy develop among rank and file workers and local union leaders in Maine, what is the relationship like to the rest of the organized labor movement, whether it's in Maine or New England or nationally?
Well, I have to give credit to Julius Getman's portrayal, Local 14, for having the definitive research and analysis on this. You know, a book he published a little over 20 years ago about the international paper strike. You know, in many ways, what I did building on his work was to fill in how did the international paper strike impact paper workers in the rest of Maine, which he has a little bit on, but I did the research on that. What had become the Union of United Paper Workers International Union, UPIU, which was a merger in the early 70s of two older, I want to call them craft unions. I mean, in labor history, this distinction between craft and industrial unions, and they were sort of from the craft union wing, which was conservative. That's where the building trades are and police unions and things like that. So that was the history of those unions. As I mentioned before, as early as the 30s and 40s, the paper companies viewed these particular unions that they, you know, were very happy to have a collaborative relationship with, which was unusual for American capital, because they weren't threatening and because the leaders were very much the union leaders. The business agents and, you know, regional vice presidents, you know, did business with the company kind of over the heads of their members. And part of the labor history that I discovered through my oral history is the growing tension between local union members, paper workers in Maine, and, you know, their national representatives. And it's a tension that brewed slowly over a couple of decades, and it kind of broke open around specifically the international paper strike in 1987 and 1988. But I have to say that, you know, one of the things I learned is that a lot of the some of the key institutional representatives in the UPIU in the 80s and 90s did adopt and embrace the local radical perspective. So it was complicated. But there's another book I want to give a shout out to. It's called Divided We Fall by Peter Kelman, who is probably the most important leader of the J strike. And he wrote a kind of book. It's very, you know, Peter Kelman's a very erudite labor activist who's written a lot and done a lot of labor history. So he tries to explain, you know, why did the J strike? What's the long history behind that? And the story he tells, and he tells it very clearly, is that, there was nothing about the leadership or culture of the unions that became the UPIU over the five decades from the 30s to 80s that prepared them for what happened in the 80s. And what happened in the 80s was, you know, corporate capital says we're done with working with unions and we're here to get rid of them or undermine them or move beyond them. And the leadership never got that. And they saw the labor movement in Maine as a threat because literally the president of Local 14 at Jay Paper, International Paper in Jay Maine, Bill Meserve, who was leading up this massive dramatic national strike because there were three other mills in other parts of the country involved. Wayne Glenn thought that he was going to lose his job to Bill Meserve and saw him as a political opponent, and that undermined how the union treated that. But again, I would say that that part of the story is told best in those two other books I just mentioned.
So we have time for two more questions. And the first I wanted to ask you about the extent of oral history that you did, right? So, we're talking now, a few decades after the fact, and you've engaged very deeply in a world of memory.
Yes.
What is the, when the workers or the people you interview, not just the workers, but the union leaders and others, remember this time, thinking now, kind of moving towards sort of contemporary politics, did they maintain a kind of radical perspective on economics or politics generally? In 2015, 17, whenever you were interviewing them, how did they see the world that had developed in the last couple of decades?
So I would say that I did the majority of my oral history interviews between 2000 and 2012. And I would say more than half I did before 2006. So it was the early 2000s that are the heart of kind of what I wound up writing about in my book. So, community memory, communities sort out what's going on with them in their present by kind of like archaeologists digging through stories of the past and then pulling them together to make sense out of the world. And I discovered something very unique. So you start doing oral history interviews, and in the first 10 interviews that I did in the S.D. Warren community in Westbrook, I turn on my tape recorder, because that was that era, I turn on my Marantz, and they would start telling me stories about the founder. And like multiple people, these kind of rescue stories. I had a grandfather, and he had a store, and there was a guy in the mill, and it was the Depression, and he was like $200 in arrears, and company came in and just, paid his bill and took a dollar out of his paycheck, until it was paid off, or, this, that, or the other thing. S.D. Warren would be rolling in his grave if he saw what they were doing now. A young man named Chris Murray, who I quote in the book, shows up for an interview, like in the first month and a half I'm doing interviews, with a stack 3 or 4 inches high of documents, including a company history and old articles and stuff, that's all about the founder of the company. And so what I learned, and then I found this in other communities as well, is that there's a term in New England for this. It's a puritanical practice called filiopietism, which is a fancy way of saying that you worship the founding fathers of whatever. The United States is what we do as a country. Well, the folks in Maine worship the founding fathers of their paper mills and the families that ran them for 3 or 4 generations after they were founded. And when I dug into it and sort of saw, it's kind of like a sculpture emerges from a block of stone. The story that they were really telling is that they had a very keen sense of a different kind of capitalism that was moral. And one of the things that I really try to emphasize when I talk about my book is that, economists don't talk about morality very much, right, in the economy. But working people experience their work lives in moral terms. Is my boss fair to me or not fair to me, or was my boss fair for a long time and stop being fair? And what accounts for that? So that's sort of like moral lens and the traumatic experience that they've gone through, again, cutting the dog's tail 1 inch at a time, companies, firing and permanently replacing striking workers, all that went on. And they said, well, when did this all start? And it started when out-of-state corporations started owning our companies. And then especially when these changes in practices in the 70s and 80s, like the business strategies of the companies, like, S.D. Warren had been making, with a very high level of skill, particular papers for 100 years. And then Scott says, we'll send it to a toilet paper mill and have them make this at a well. And then they would screw up the product and the customers nationally would stop buying it. And then the mill in Westbrook would lose, 100 jobs as a result. So they saw all of that. And they built what I called a folk political economy, which was basically a history of capitalism and their industry that correlates to exactly what economic historians, you know, as I was talking about earlier, see, which is that there was this kind of stakeholder managerial, like, you know, the managers, the top managers of a company would look out for the long term of the company by investing in R&D. They would look out for the workers by being generous in terms of wages and benefits and accommodating unions. And what Wall Street, you know, brought to American capitalism around 1975 is that, you know, paying workers well is stealing profits from shareholders. And so they had a very keen sense of all of this, and they could tell it the way you find out when you do oral history. And this is what happened in 71. This is what happened in 77. This is what started to happen in the 80s. And so, you know, I give them credit for having their own economic analysis that comports with the sort of highest level academic analyses that as a scholar I'm familiar with, and actually tracked quite well. But it was of their own making.
Yeah, it's just super fascinating. And to build on that, you know, with our last question, I guess, again, about the impact of this on a contemporary manner, you know, the politics in rural Maine have moved to the right in the way that they have moved to the right in much of America, particularly in white rural communities. And so I guess, you know, I'm wondering, when we read your book, or for that matter, when we listen to you talk about the kind of really sophisticated, you know, political or, you know, political economy that working class people are able to develop, are there lessons that we can take for, you know, for trying to wrap our heads around the political situation right now, but also one of the issues that's causing that, which is the realities of global capitalism and the way a lot of these communities have been left behind. So if there's a takeaway that readers can or listeners can get from your book, what is that takeaway?
Well, you know, two things I'd say about your question, one of which is that I've thought a lot about it on my own, and I get asked a lot about it since my book came out. So what I would say is that, you know, if you go back to, you know, that moral perspective, like, hey, we make the best paper in the world, and we have for 100 years. And people still buy paper. And why has global capital abandoned us? You know, so that's one question. But then an overlapping question is like, okay, it's been 25 years. And during this 25 years, since a more pronounced decline in employment, which started in the mid 90s, you know, you've seen nobody in Washington and few people in Augusta, which is our state capital, doing much about their circumstances. And I think that, when you talk to people in any blue collar industrial community that's seen their mills or their factories attenuate and then close down, and then everybody suffers a lot of downward mobility as a result. And, you know, there's a lot of certain kinds of pathologies like drug issues are really like pretty serious in rural Maine. And you ask them all about that, and you sort of think, well, the Democratic Party of Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton all supported the trade deals that they do associate as, you know, in the full light of the 21st century is one of the reasons why their kinds of jobs have gone away. But even more than that, like the absence of any kind of proactive strategy to prevent the downward mobility that these people have been facing in droves. So, you know, both Republican and Democratic parties, to use a term that most of your listeners will be familiar with, sort of embraced neoliberalism in the 90s and 2000s, probably up until maybe the last several years, thanks to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. And so, you know, I close the book by saying that it was pretty clear in the machinations and activism after 2000, you know, sort of heroic attempts to try and save mills that the governors would be involved in, things like that, that people don't buy the idea that, you know, the market rules and what, you know, chips fall where they may. And if your industry goes down, then, you know, like a good economic theorist, you should like jump up and, you know, move to some other part of the country, you know, frictionlessly into a new industry that's growing. And, you know, the world just doesn't work like that. And so, you know, what I bring up is that I think, you know, they would have been very pleased to have seen the kind of industrial policy that other countries had. I mentioned that China spent $20 billion in the two aughts on papermaking technology, which helped them take away some of the remaining industry from Maine, the United States. And we're not doing that here. So what's so interesting about the moment that we're at right now is that, you know, in a rhetorical way, Donald Trump said, let's move on beyond neoliberalism and let's, you know, fight for blue collar jobs in the country. Now, he didn't really do it. He just said it. He performed it like verbally, but he didn't actually have policies that succeeded in that. And now you have the Biden administration talking about, you know, is effectively a green industrial policy to try and reach into places like where coal miners are. So, I mean, I think what it all boils down to is that their insight is that institutions and policies should be imbued, as much as they have to be like technically effective, they should be imbued with that kind of moral sensibility about the lives of people who devote themselves to, you know, a career in some particular industry that has, you know, continued to contribute to our overall political economy. So we had very little of that in the last three or four decades. And I think we're getting a lot more of that right now, in part because I mean, there was a thing in the New York Times today about how corporations are finding that both Democrats and Republicans at this point, for all kinds of different reasons, you know, have abandoned them. And corporate America is like all of a sudden falling all over itself to saying, all right, we're abandoning shareholder primacy and we're going to be, you know, pursuing environmental and social goals, you know, in the way we govern our corporations, because, you know, they've overdone it. And people recognize that. So, you know, I don't begrudge people in rural Maine rejecting either of the political parties for what they didn't do over the last 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, I want to just say that was a really great conversation. And thank you so much. We've been talking for the last half an hour or so with Michael Hillard, who is a professor of economics at the University of Southern Maine. And we've been talking about his new book, Shredding Paper, The Rise and Fall of Maine's Mighty Paper Industry. And it is available from Cornell University Press. Michael, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure, Eric. Thank you very much.
And we'll be back soon with another LGM podcast.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.